Okay, we'll start on page 113. So these are some related but some disparate different halakhos related to things that come up in the kitchen and the principles behind them. So sometimes a situation comes up and you call the rabbi, whether it's me or a previous rabbi or another rabbi you know, and you describe the situation. Second. You describe a situation, and the rabbi tells you it's kosher, it's not kosher, you have to kosher the item, whatever it is. But tonight we'll have the opportunity to start exploring some of these principles. So we start on page 113, just with the general idea of using separate utensils in the kitchen. And one could argue that if everything's cold and whatnot, so you really need separate plates. You need separate knives if you washed everything. But in order to prevent any mishaps with us, so the practice is to have a separate section, separate utensils, separate dishes. So Rama writes in source one, Shulchan Aruch, Karnagu Kol Yisrael Lios Lahem Shnei Sakinim, should have two different knives. And if everything's cold, so maybe you wouldn't really have a problem. But we try to be very careful. We make sure we have two sets of knives, two different knives. And one should mark them to distinguish between basar b'chalav. So back in the days of the Ramah, you did not have those dairy and meat, the blue and red dairy and meat stickers that you can now get at Gift World or wherever it is. But there needs to be some sort of marking to differentiate between the dairy and meat. And the Ramah goes on to add, "V'nagu lirshom shel chalav." Custom was specifically to mark the dairy one, so not necessary to mark both the dairy and the meat, although could do that. But specifically to mark the dairy one, "V'ein lishamas b'nach shel Yisrael." One should be careful not to. Distinct to change the custom of the Jewish people. The Kaf HaChaim says that this is not just for knives. So the Ramah just says having two different knives, but the Kaf HaChaim introduces idea of having two different types of utensils. So nowadays it's very easy that you can have different, different shapes, different designs. So to have different, to have those different types so that it's very easy to distinguish. Okay, but a couple of miles like goats, so it's not just knives, of course, but spoons and forks. Okay, call killing all the utensils. Hold last of charitim ala, or one should mark the dairy ones. And this is the custom of all of the Jewish people. So we have this custom to have different just have different sets and also to mark them. So does one have to mark the different dairy and meat utensils if they're entirely let's say if they're entirely different types? So the Badei HaShulchan, which I've mentioned over the last couple of weeks, the Refival Cohen, he, see, this is the cover of the book. He passed away a couple of weeks ago. So he explicitly says that one can buy different utensils and then you don't have to mark them. So let's say you have, the exact same set, but you divide them between dairy and meat. So then you will need to mark them. And the Rama said the custom was to mark the dairy ones, and it's a minhag Yisrael and should not be changed. The reason why you should mark the dairy ones specifically is because if some people mark the dairy ones and some people mark the meat ones, so you don't necessarily know which is which. Everyone's, if somebody comes into your kitchen, so people are confused if they're different systems. So the custom was to mark the dairy ones, and that was the custom of the Jewish people. But at the same time, the Kaf HaChaim says that one can have two different types of utensils, and the Bnei Shulchan says that if you have two different types, then you really don't need to, you don't really need to mark them. If it's, now, of course, again, someone's a guest in your kitchen, so you have to tell them, you know, which is which, but at least for the people in the household, you know very clearly what is what, as does, as do the housekeepers. Once you've initiated them, then housekeeper will also be able to tell the difference between them.
These are the serving utensils, I assume.
What?
You're not going to mark a set for 10 people, every fork and every knife and every spoon with a label. I guess the serving utensils that look the same.
No, I think it's really everything. Because if again, nowadays it's so easy to get you know, different designs and shapes, so you don't have to mark them. But in theory, if they were all going to be the same, then you'd have to be very careful to mark them so you know what's what. Doesn't matter if it's serving or the ones you eat with, but you need to know what's what.
My dairy utensils.
Oh, you got the disposable nowadays.
Okay, right. So that's a marker. That's a marker. You talked about a charitz. It sounds like you're like kind of like an indentation or something like that. But okay. So the Taz also talks about having different salt shakers, one for dairy, one for meat. Mm-hmm. He says, this is source 3 on page 114. Because makom shabechani minhag Ashkenaz sheyesh lam kelim asuim lamelof echad lebasar veechad lechalav. So I want to praise the Ashkenazi minhag to have separate salt shakers because it could be that one takes salt during the meal when they have some meat schmaltz on their hand or some cheese schmaltz on their hand. So you don't want your hands going into the same thing. So he talks about having different salt shakers. So the Tosfos Halacha in source 4 says that that's not so necessary nowadays because we don't really put our hands inside the salt, but now our salt shakers have are generally covered on top, and you have the little holes. So in that case, you don't really need to have separate.
Yeah, but people use those non-salt shakers to take on Shabbos to salt.
That's usually just the challah.
What?
Hmm?
What?
No. They're not salt shakers. They're little things with salt in them where you pick it with your fingers.
Right. Where I had one growing up where there was like a spoon. So in that case, and according to the Taz, then one should really have if you're only using it for Shabbos, then presumably it's meat. But if you're going to use it for Yontif, if you have some dairy meals, then dairy you should have a separate one for a dairy, according to the Taz. The Aruch HaShulchan says that those who make daktikin to have people who are scrupulous to have three different knives. One for basar, one for chalav, and one for bread. So this brings us a little bit back to the discussion from last week. But the notion of having a parv knife for vegetables, to have a parv knife for cutting bread. So, in as much as the Ramah had discussed having separate knives for dairy and meat, so there's also maybe a reason to have a parv one where you don't have the issue when it comes to power. Okay, let's go to page 116. Here we're going to learn an important foundation as far as basar b'chalav goes, as far as mixtures go. There's the concept in halacha called a tam ki'ikar, or tam ki'ikar. So tam means taste. So the idea of tam ki'ikar is that the taste of something is like the substance itself. I guess to use a very basic example, I mentioned a case a couple weeks ago where somebody had a deli in the fridge and they had chocolate in the fridge and the deli started tasting and they noticed that the deli tasted like chocolate. So there was no chocolate in the deli, but Rav Schechter had paskind that that it's usher to eat it. And that's from a basic principle of tam ki ikar, that if you can taste the chocolate, it's as if the chocolate is there itself. So likewise, let's say I'm making French onion soup, which is dairy, and a piece of meat falls into it. So even if I remove the meat, so I'm not having meat with my French onion soup. It's not like I'm having the meat and cheese together. But in the situation that the taste from the meat remains, so it's as if I'm having the meat itself, even though the meat is removed. So that's the notion of tam ki'ikar. So where does this concept come from?
Excuse me. So yeah. You're saying that if it didn't have the taste of the meat, we would be okay eating it? I mean, you
Yeah.
know, the way we run our households is, I guess, is
Well,
not
okay,
exactly.
so we'll see the evolution here, but that's the basic principle, is that, and we'll see that the cases where you can say that there's absolutely no case, so those cases are slim. But in theory, if I could prove that there is absolutely no taste whatsoever, so I wouldn't have a problem. This principle potentially comes from a pasuk in Parshas Naso by the Nazir, which is an interesting source. But the Nazir is not allowed to have wine. And source 6 in the third pasuk, it says, not supposed to have new wine, aged wine, not vinegar from new wine or aged wine, should not drink anything in which grapes have been steeped. So in other words, if I put the grapes in and I take the grapes out, that's a problem for the Nazir, because there are grapes in them. So the Gemara Pesachim learns from this. Tisanya, Mishras Litain Tam Ki'ikar. The notion of the soaked grapes teaches us a principle of Tam Ki'ikar, that the taste of a forbidden food is like that of its substance. She'im Shara Anavim B'mayim V'yesh Bam Tam Yain Chayev. For a Nazir, if you put grapes in the water and it has the taste of the grapes or taste of wine, he's liable for that. So mikana tadan the kol atar kula. So therefore, this applies to the entire Torah. That if I put meat in my French onion soup and I take out that meat, but I can still taste that meat, it's as if the meat is still in there. This is a principle that applies in the whole Torah. So the grass
what,
here.
What do you excuse me? What do you do with the bracha of the previous one, where you now have to make a bor pri hagafen?
Meaning that if I put grapes in water and it tastes like, no, but I mean with the nazir we're extra strict, so I don't know if that necessarily makes it strong enough for bor pri hagafen. But remember that we're extremely strict from the defenses that we put around, the siyagim that we put around a nazir are very, very strong.
But how can you even taste the soup? Once the meat falls into it, you can't taste it to tell if you taste the taste of meat or not.
Okay, all right. So we'll address how we deal with that in a second. So the Gras says in source eight, that the Kaimalan times ke iker deraisa. This is a Torah law, and we learn that as a real interpretation from the Torah that we learn from the Nazir. So this is a Torah law of Tam Ki Iker. This is actually the subject of a strong machlokas between Rashi and Tosfos. Tosfos also hold that Tam Ki Iker is from the Torah, but Rashi actually held that Tam Ki Iker is a halacha derabanan. So they discuss it a little bit more in the appendix on page 139. But it's worth noting that Rashi thinks that it's derabanan, but that's a strong otherwise, we hold it deraisa. That's a strong machlokas. Okay, source 9, Gemara Zvachim. So, how do we define what taste is? So one thing I guess I'll note here, there are a couple of ways of determining taste. So one thing that actually is brought up in Shulchan Aruch was the idea of giving a non-Jew, if you weren't sure if there was a taste in it, so you could give it to a non-Jew, and it had to be what we call a kfela. It has to be somebody who was a chef or some sort of food expert. If they could taste any, let's say in the case that I gave, if there's any meat taste in my French onion soup. That was one way that was mentioned in the Gemara and in the Shulchan Aruch. There was a concern, however, that a kfela might apply, and there's concerns about the practicality of it. So the line could go in two directions. Either the non-Jew hates Jews and wants to trip them up and tell them that it's kosher and it's really not, or the non-Jew feels really bad, and he's a nice person, feels really bad, so he's going to say that it's kosher when it's really not. So we don't rely on kfela anymore. So what do we have to... without actually tasting the substance, how can we figure out whether or not there would be taste in parts? So the Gemara in Zvachim in source 9 says, "Amar Rava, So some sages said that the status is determined by, goes by taste, and some said that really a majority is enough. So if I can determine that there is more kosher substance than non-kosher substance, or this, you know, or the, let's say if you have basar b'chalav, so there's the chalav far outweighs the basar, then perhaps that would be sufficient. But the Gemara explains that that depends on what the nature of the mixture is. Min b'sh'eno mino. If I have two food items that are different types, they have different tastes, so then it goes by taste. If it's min b'mino, if it's two foods of this of the same type, then it's beruba. Then it goes by the majority, right? So if I so let's say you have kosher meat and non-kosher meat. Okay, so they're both beef, but one is shechted and one's not shechted. So so in that case, you have a min b'mino. So then maybe you could go by the majority. If the majority of the items are kosher meat, so that's sufficient to be able to eat at least some of it. If it's min b'sheino mino, so let's say I have again, you know, French onion soup with meat, so then I have to go by the taste. With that said, there's a contradicting Gemara in Avodah Zarah, source 10, that says it's Machlokes Shin Rav and Shmuel. So they say Ko Isurin Shbatara B'Minan B'Mashu. Actually, so Rav and Shmuel, Machlokes is different. Actually, it's Rav and Shmuel hold the same thing, and Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish hold a separate thing. So it's an interesting four-way of Machlokes. So Rav and Shmuel hold that min b'mino, if the two items are of the same same type, so then they are forbidden with any amount. We hold that way on Pesach. Right? On Pesach, we hold that any chametz that falls into let's say you have you know, you have chametz brownies and kosher Pesach brownies. So if they mix at all, even if it's, you know, this amount, so then that's forbidden. But shelo b'minan, if they're two different types, then it's benosein kam. Then it goes by taste. Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, however, say that when it comes to min b'mino, when it comes to both of them, we go by it. We go by taste. Okay, so nothing about majority. Nothing about the majority is brought up here. So we have a little bit of a contradiction between the Gemara in Zvachim that says that that if it's min b'mino, if it's two items of the same type, that you can go by the majority, whereas Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish seem to hold that it has to go by taste, or according to Rav and Shmuel, even any of it would be forbidden. So the
Rashi. What about but? Where does the concept of batel b'shishim, the 60 times more kosher than unkosher?
So we're gonna see that in about 5 seconds. So the Ran says in source 11 that the notion of rov, of something being nullified, if it's a mere minority, so that's really only according to Torah law. But by rabbinic law, no matter what, it has to go by taste, and we do that through 60. So the idea of batel b'shishim, which is a concept that people may have heard of before, the idea of batel b'shishim, that there has to be 60 times of a permitted substance, as opposed to, you know, it has to be a 60 to 1 ratio of permitted and non permitted substance, or 60 dairy to 1 meat. So that's based, that's that the purpose of that is to determine whether or not there's taste. So if, let's say, you know, if I have meat in my French onion soup and I'm making an industrial sized soup and there's this amount of meat, so then we assume that that's batel b'shishim, and that's not really imparting taste, right? If I can take out the meat, I should, but otherwise, if there's 60 times dairy over meat, so that's enough to assume that taste has not been imparted. However, if there's less than 60, then if there's less than 60, then I have to assume that there's some taste, and then that substance becomes not permitted. Susan, did that make sense?
Yeah.
You're muted.
Thing is how you measure it.
Susan, you're muted.
She's muted, yeah.
No, but again, the idea of I would be afraid to taste something if something on kosher fell in it, even to determine on my own if it was bottled to shishim or whatever. I don't know.
Right. So, I mean, you're right. So it's like, we don't, like, what kind of measuring devices do we have? Like, is it exactly 60 times? So I'd say like this, like, again, like, if you're like, my wife has a chicken soup pot that's like, you know, like this tall. Right? If that pot is full and one piece of mozzarella cheese falls in there, I can probably assume that's bata bashishin. Take it out, even if it melts, I can probably assume that's bata bashishin. But in many cases, that's obviously very difficult. So number one, a machmir tava la bracha, you know, certainly if you can throw it out, you know, if you cannot have it, that's obviously better. Where these leniencies might come up is if there's a reason why, let's say it's, you know, it's 20 minutes before Shabbos and something like this happens, you're not going to have food. So, you know, that's something to think about. If there's a hefsin ruba, if there's going to be a tremendous loss, so that's something to think about. But I certainly agree that determining whether there's 60 times the, you know, whether there's a 60 to 1 ratio is not necessarily easy.
Could I ask you about, besides eating, what happens to the pot?
Okay, so that's what's about to come up in sources 13 and
the other thing is, in case this happens and it's okay and you're having guests over, would you inform your guests? I don't
know. I mean, if it's truly bata bashishin, then, like, you know, don't even go there. If it's kosher, it's kosher. You don't I wouldn't scare people, because, you know, either it's kosher and it's fine and, you know, it's not worth bringing up, or it's not kosher and don't bring it up. A very tangential story, but I had a Rebbe who was asked a mamzer shiloh. A student of his had come to him and thought that there are reasons why he might be a mamzer. So he took down all the details of the case. He went to Rav Aaron Lechlinstein and asked the question. So Rav Aaron said that, you know, after listening to Shai, Rav Aaron said, tell this boy that he is 100% not a mamzer, and tear up this piece of paper and tell him to never ask the Shaila again. Right? Mm-hmm. So, like, you know, sometimes, you know, once you determine that you're kosher, and don't ask any more questions and don't give anybody reasons to doubt. Okay, so Shulchan Aruch says, the chaticha she'ena re'uya le'iskabet. So this concept is that a piece that is not suitable for honoring guests. Okay, so for example, a piece of chicken is something you serve guests. You know, a couple of, I don't know, a couple of pieces of couscous are probably not. So a chaticha she'ena liskabesh and isarva ba'acheros min b'mino yavesh b'yavesh. So you have, this is couscous is a good example, because two solid substances, but they're both solid. So let's say for some reason one was kosher and one was treif. So they can be nullified by a majority. And the Ramah is very clear that this is only min b'mino when they are of the same type. But if they're not of the same type, they're enomino. So even if they're solid, you need 60. So in order to rely on the majority for nullification and to assume that there's no taste, so it would need to be a relatively insignificant item of food, and it would have to be solid, and both items would have to be the same substance. Otherwise, you have to use the ratio of 60 to 1. So how does this apply to cases that come up with pots and pans and spoons and the like? So Shulchan Aruch says in source 13 on page 119, Hatochev kaf cholevis b'deri shel basar. If I take a dairy spoon and put it in a meat pot, in my chicken soup, or ipcha, I take a meat spoon and I put it in my French onion soup pot. So mesharim b'chol mashenitzcha b'menu b'deri. So we have to estimate the amount that was inserted into the pot. You have to determine that that there's a 60 to 1 ratio of soup and pot to that spoon. So if you happen to just dab like the tip of that spoon in only to realize that it was the wrong thing, you take it out. So maybe that's batel b'shishim. If you stick the whole thing in, again, you know, I don't know if the spoon is 60, whatever. I might have problems there. So likewise, the Shulchan Aruch goes on to say, if there's 60 to nullify the spoon, shishin l'batel kaf, so agdera v'tasha mutarim aval kaf aser. So if there is 60 times, food against the spoon, so I'm allowed to eat the dish and the pot is fine. I don't have to kasher it, but the spoon becomes forbidden and I would have to kasher it. And I can't have it. I can't have it with basar. I can't have it there. I can't have it with meat. Because at that point, the spoon is assumed to be a mixture of dairy and meat. So in the case that there is that I can rely on batel b'shishim, when I stick that spoon in, let's say again, it's a very small spoon in a very big pot, and I only inserted part of the spoon in. So then the spoon I would have to kasher, but the food and the pot itself is fine. Im ein shishim, there's not 60. Hakol aser b'hanam, all of it is forbidden even to benefit from. So the pot is problematic. So what I could do is I could use it to put in, to put in fruit or to put in anything that would be cold, because then I'm not really benefiting from any forbidden substance in the pot. But if I can't determine that there's 60 times, the spoon, then the spoon has to be kosher, the food has to be thrown out, the pot has to be kosher. Okay. So the Gemara in Chulin goes on to say, verse 14, there should be shal ba basar, lo yivashal ba chala, v'im bishal b'no sintan. So if I have a meat pot, I should not cook dairy in it. And if I did cook dairy in my meat pot, then I have to go by the amount of flavor that's imparted. So Shulchan Aruch says, "Dair shibisha ba basar lo yivashal ba chalav." If I have a meat pot, I can't cook dairy in it. V'im bisha ba betoch me'es la'es aser benotem tam. So if I did cook in it within 24 hours of having used it, let's say it's a meat pot. So if I cook dairy in it within 24 hours of having cooked meat in it. So I have to figure out if there's a 60-to-1 ratio of meat to dairy. So again, like one little piece of cheese God put in there, maybe I don't have a problem. But I should be koshering that pot. So the note here, this is important. It says in general, there's rarely ever bitzel b'shishim in either of these cases of cooking in the wrong type of pot or inserting the wrong type of spoon into the pot, as the ratio of the surface of the pot to the food or utensil is usually much greater than 1 to 60. So this is noted by the Beis Yosef, who suggests that bitzel b'shishim would only be relevant in a few specific cases. So the Beis Yosef says, often in the case there's not a proportion of 60 times within what is in the utensil to the entire utensil. Alternatively, it may occur when the pot is so wide that it holds enough water equivalent to 60 times of the surface area of the pot, such as if the surface is very thin and very wide. So again, so if you're dealing with industrial size utensils and you have a small mishap that takes place, so you might have what to rely on. But you know, if you're using like a small pot and you put in like a sort of big wooden spoon, you're gonna have problems. You're gonna have to kosher things.
This rarely comes up. There's not going to be difficult decisions. If you have a good sized pot and I take a spoon that's dairy,
yeah,
a regular spoon, not a gigantic spoon, the spoon becomes contaminated, but the pot's not contaminated.
If the spoon is batel b'shishim, so
yeah.
Again, it could come up if your pot is big enough and the spoon is small enough. But
usually the pot is much bigger than the spoon.
60 times, you see if you can put in 60 spoons into the pot, and then you have to deal with also the surface area and. So it can be complicated. So the other thing that comes up at the end here is the issue of lids. So mm-hmm. Take a hot lid from a meat pot and then I put it on top of a dairy pot. So if they're both hot, then both the pot and the lid are forbidden. If there is meat in the meat pot and dairy in the dairy pot, if the lid was cold and the pot was hot, so they're still forbidden. If there's steam coming from the pot, because tatat, we have a principle tatagvar that steam rises. So if you put a meat top on top of a meat lid on top of a dairy pot, and everything's cold, so you're not going to have a problem. But if the pot is hot, and especially if the lid is hot, so both of them would require would require kashering. Prima Gadim says it's true, even if it's not yatzal lettuce boat, even if it's not to the point where your hand would recoil, if it's not burning hot. But if it's warm, so then we would have to kasher.
But the food's still okay? But the food's still okay?
Is the food still okay? Well, so I guess that would depend on whether the lid was hot. If the lid was hot, then I would think that it would depend on bitul b'shishi, in which case you probably don't have enough to do that. But if the lid was not hot and you quickly take it off, so the food is probably fine, but you'd have to kasher the lid.
This is not if the lid is glass, then it doesn't matter. Have a pot with a glass lid.
The edge is probably metal.
Right.
The edge around the lid is metal. The edge around the lid is metal.
It could be some metal. So I'll try to answer that next week. I have some
glass. Well, actually, they're not glass. They're like Pyrex, which I guess does not count as glass. But Pyrex doesn't count as glass. But the Pyrex lids don't have any metal on them.
No,
they don't have.
I'll try to investigate some of these different variations next week. With that said, we still have a little here. I'm gonna